All of you, it's great to be in Russia, it's great to be in Siberia, and it's great to be in Tomsk. And thank you for turning out so many of you. I come from a far island in the Atlantic Ocean. We have, of course, cold, but we have the sea surrounding Iceland, so it never gets as cold as 27, minus 27, very, very seldom. Maybe next slide. I'm very thankful for the prize given to me, and I wanted to tell you that Russia did not open up my eyes just because of the prize. I am, in fact, a product of Russian physics. My great-great-great-grandfather, academically, was Professor Kapitsa in Cambridge. He taught Lonsarich, Lonsarich taught Pippard, Pippard taught Gold, Gold, Lonsarich, and Sigfusson. So I'm very proud of. And my best physics book in Cambridge, where, very good to see you. Congratulations with the 25 years anniversary. My best physics book in my studies were Landau and Lifshitz, of course. Best textbook ever written for physics. So great pleasure to be with you. Let's go to my story. My story is a little bit about an unusual development of energy in a little island of 300,000 people, Iceland. Next slide, please. So what we enjoy in Iceland is, of course, yeah, I'm just playing with the green energy there, green renewable, if you like. If you look at our situation on the world map, we have a very high per capita income. We're, of course, a very large consumer of energy, among the highest in the world. Let's go to the next slide. So you can see here the sort of statistics for Iceland. We are mainly hydroelectric and geothermal. And the hydroelectric, you can see that the potential is very high, about 30,000 gigawatt hours. And if you go to the geothermal, we have a bit different story, but still 20,000 gigawatt hours. If you're thinking, it's like a 55 terawatt hours is the maximum for our country. We have no natural fossil fuels in Iceland. There's no coal, there's no oil, there's a little peat, lousy peat somewhere. So we are totally dependent on import of fossil fuels for our economy. So our cars, our boats, the fishing boats, use a lot, and our airplanes use all oil. Next slide, please. The origin of the great gift of geothermal is the fact that Iceland is situated between the plates of the plate boundaries on Earth, between the Eurasian plate and the North American plate. These plates are coming apart with about 2.5 centimeters a year, and magma is forced up in between. The good thing about this is that, okay, they're coming apart, but they're not. Earthquakes are not a big problem in Iceland. The largest we have happens every about century or so in the southern part here, and it's about six-ish or so, and we build very, very good houses. But unlike California, where plates are coming together, Iceland will go apart, and it's a bit softer for earthquakes. You may have heard about this guy in the news recently. This is Eyjafjallajökull, the glacier that erupted, and it's a very, very powerful generator of maybe it's an assembly of 25 or 30 nuclear generators in energy. And then it makes a lot of ashes, and then you know how problematic the flights, international flights were because of this. Next slide, please. So the beauty of Icelandic energy is then that we have had, of course, in
1930 or so, we were very much coal oriented around the beginning of the World War II. We then went to import oil. Please come in, no problem. Yep. And welcome. We then started harnessing geothermal and hydroelectric, and of course oil was a big part of our energy to continue with, quite a big part. And if you look at the situation now, what is coal doing here? Guess what? It's used effectively as electrodes in our aluminum smelting, ferrosilicon production, only electrodes. No other use of coal, really. Please come in. So, but the big challenge in Iceland is that because we use all this oil with our fishing fleet, with our cars, some heating, but most of the heating is geothermal, we have about 18%, oh, what did I say? 18 tons per year per person CO2. Very high figure. At the same time, we have the highest use of renewables in the world. 82% of our energy comes from renewables. So this has created a very interesting challenge for us, and this challenge made me work in this area of physics. I wanted to somehow make us more renewable. Next slide, please. I'll just put it in an interesting diagram. It's a three-phase diagram. I call this one 100% coal, 100% oil and gas, 100% renewables. Iceland was here in 1930. We moved away gradually up to here, where we in fact started using electricity to smelt aluminium and make some heavy industries in that field. But we moved more and more to the use of renewables. Next slide shows you the goal of our complete, I call it hydrogen economy, because it's not only about hydrogen, it's also about the possibility of hydrogen-related designer fuels, fuels that need hydrogen, and I'll show you something more afterwards. And if you do next slide, you can see that this is the, no, sorry, going back, there's only a little thing on the hydrogen economy goal. So this is the hydrogen economy goal here, and it would be a fantastic thing if we could reach the state of using mostly renewable for all of our energy. We can never come down to here because of our smelters, because of our, I think, airplanes will be very difficult to run on hydrogen. Though I must tell you that Russia was very impressive, or the old Soviet Union, by running a Tupolev on hydrogen, partly. The first in the world. So, very interesting possibilities, I think, there. Next slide, please. So these are really the challenges that we are faced with in order to decarbonize, to get rid of carbon in our economy. The first one is to make hydrogen from renewables. We can do it with electrolysis, for example, and we do that. It's also about pure hydrogen. We have now in Iceland about 25 cars running on hydrogen daily, and a station I'll show you later. But there's a lot of possibilities also to use hydrogen for, may I say, hydrogen-related fuels. And we are making designer fuels from hydrogen and CO2. We simply take hydrogen, green hydrogen, we take CO2 from boreholes, we can also take it from the industry. We have a catalysis system with copper, and we make methanol. This methanol is going to be put, mixed into our car fuels, and by maybe 6-7%, and so we will reduce the need for import of oil, as we are supplying homemade green methanol to the game. We can, of course, also capture CO2 through vegetation and soil, but Iceland is of course very northerly, very arctic, so vegetation is limited, but it's very, very important part of our plan anyway. We can also capture and store CO2 by geological methods, and we can actually use boreholes, geothermal boreholes, and I have now shown you an aluminum smelter. Aluminium produces 1.8 tons of CO2 for every ton of aluminium. So if you have 500,000 tons produced here annually, there's a lot of CO2. And let me see the next slide, because it should show you the idea behind geological storage of CO2. Iceland has a very young basalt. This young basalt contains a lot of calcium aluminates, aluminum silicates, I should say. And you take some CO2, you take some water, you put this fizzy water into the ground, and it will actually make use of the calcium, fresh calcium ions, and it will produce calcium carbonate. And we're doing this in one place near Reykjavik, where we use a borehole, and hundreds of tons have been absorbed, but it's of course a very slow process. It's a process nature uses, so the engineering trick here is to make it fast enough. But it's a beautiful way of utilizing the power of basalt to absorb CO2. Next slide, please. But of course, the beauty of our geothermal is all the use of hot water, summer and winter. This is a rotating restaurant in Reykjavik based on a station for hot water storage to create a constant hydrostatic pressure for the whole of the town. Next slide shows you the enjoyment, of course, of warm water. And so this is a great thing to have in little Iceland. And I sometimes talk about Iceland. Iceland is almost it's like an oil district, like a Texas of renewable energy through the water, through the warm water. Next slide, please. You may ask me about the 20,000 gigawatt hours of geothermal. Is that the limit? And the answer is, of course, no. Because if we drill deeper towards the magma intrusion, where the magma is coming to the surface, we will increase the temperature a lot, and we will reach the supercritical temperature of water. We are trying this now. There have been some problems in the north of Iceland where we drilled in a caldera, but the caldera was not very happy and started erupting through the borehole. So we created a little volcano. So it's a very daring project to try to get so close. But give you an example. If we have found out that drilling about 4 kilometers or so, we will make a tenfold increase of the electric power of a given borehole. They are now giving about 10 megawatts electric, each of them. You may ask me, what about the other part? Well, it's a 88% inefficient, so 88% is left as heat. 12-13% normally as electricity. If we go to this depth, we're going to tenfold the electricity, about 100 megawatts per borehole. In that vision of mine, we need 10 boreholes, deep boreholes, to create the effect of a nuclear power plant. So very, very good. What do we need to do? Please come in. We need to do something to get more out of the heat energy, because now we have heated Reykjavik, central heating, heated most of our towns, so we need some industry that is based on heat. And I would like to discuss that a lot in Russia during my time here. Anyway, next slide, please. You know, all of you, of course, that this is the Ring of Fire, where the plates are giving rise to volcanic activities. In Iceland, it's a very special place. It's the only place on Earth where an ocean ridge reaches the surface. So we're actually living on the surface of an ocean ridge where it just reaches the surface. Okay, next slide, please. So the challenge we are faced with in Iceland is, of course, this paradox. We have a wonderful 82% renewables. The rest of the world is maybe less than 10, especially OECD, the G20 countries. We have 18 tons of CO2. We're almost as bad as the Americans, with a lot of CO2 for our society. It's an expensive lifestyle, big four-wheel drive SUVs, and so on and so forth. And our trawlers use a lot of oil when they trawl in the net in the ocean, you know, up to about $2 million ticket for oil, trawler oil, every year, 1 year. Very expensive. And this, of course, sparks off a lot of innovation in fuels and energy. And I have very great hopes that my cooperation with Russian scientists here, especially here in Tomsk, also in Novosibirsk, will help us solve some of these problems. And together, my little country of Iceland and the big country and nation of Russia can do wonders together, I think. And I'm very happy to see the students in here with us, especially because I think this is a future we can create together with the help of the wonderful staff of your university and down in Novosibirsk. We can move mountains, I think. And I'm very glad to have the opportunity. This talk of mine was announced with a very short notice. I think it was announced yesterday or something. Very grateful for the turnout. But there will be, I think, the professor Yuri, there will be a lot of possibilities, I think, for PhD and master's work in our cooperation. So I look forward to seeing some of you there. Next slide, please. Yeah, I don't need to tell you about this. This is from another lecture where, of course, CO2 is going up a lot and creating a lot of problems. The dollar of 120, I think, dollars for a barrel of oil now. When I started my work in Iceland with hydrogen, the break-even for a station, hydrogen station, was $50 a barrel. It's 120 today. So it's getting out of hand totally. Next slide, please. So I'm going to tell you a few stories about engineering solutions now. They're about saving oil. Of course, we have to save oil in the trawlers. They cannot cope with $2 million a year oil. We have to put CO2 into fuels. And I will tell you about the Carbon Recycling International company. And this company will probably be working with some catalyst experts in Russia. I will tell you a little bit about moon power harnessing, tidal forces. I'll tell you a little bit about osmosis, which is the forefront of our technological engineering work. Next slide, please. So we have a little company in Iceland, and this is another message for you. I would like the excellence of Russian science and engineering to be turned into spin-off companies that will produce goods for the market and make your life in Russia more enjoyable, in the sense that you will have a more production of high value added goods. We have a little company in Iceland making really looking at a trawler, going through all the bookkeeping of the energy use, and by administrative savings, they can get about 15%
60-70% saving of the oil use. It's like an intelligent system with a skipper who tells how to behave energy wise. Next slide, please. So, yeah, sorry, I told you, I said $1 million, it's €2 million, so it's even higher. What should we say, $3 million, enormous amount. And you don't have the ocean here, but the ocean can be very harsh in my country. Next slide, please. So then let's go to electrical engineering. The diesel generators on board some of these trawlers have problems with too much noise, anharmonics, because the diesel generators, there's a diesel, then there's an electric generator, and then there's an electric propeller. If you have a problem like many of them have here, you are bound to have high frequency, very high frequency in the engine room. That will lead to eddy currents. The eddy currents will dissipate energy, and by filtering out anharmonics and high frequency, this company has showed about up to 20% savings of oil use. On the next slide, well, you can see their product. It's a spin-off again. They make these little or large things for different trawlers. They call it L-correct. They correct the down to 50 hertz. And a skipper has told me that the payback was 6 months. In 6 months, he had saved this investment. I'm also sure that in a cooperation with Russian engineering and science, we could benefit, make this even better. Next slide, please. Another message I've been giving to my nation is, why don't we treat CO2 as a raw material? Why just always look at it as a bad thing? And on the next slide, you will see the process where we have simply been using, we call it Carbon Recycling International as a company. We use CO2 from the boreholes. There's a lot of natural CO2. We can also use it from the industry, but we start this way. We use green electricity for electrolyzing water, and with the assistance of the catalysts here, we make an addition to the classical fuels. We call it renewable methanol, or maybe I should say green methanol. And in May this year, we're starting a little factory near a geothermal power station south of Reykjavik. We'll probably be producing, I think I'm right saying, about 30 barrels an hour or something. It's not huge, but it's quite considerable. Next slide, please. I come to designer fuels. What do I mean by designer fuels? Well, to me, if I see CO2 as a raw material, I start thinking about how can we design, how does our Lord create fuels? he would be thinking about a carbon part, a hydrogen part. Different mixtures of these things lead to different types of, and I've also put the oxidizer in here. When I burn these things here, I combine them with oxygen, and out comes CO2 or H2O. These are the combustion products, right? Very different ratio. What is the most beautiful of all? Of course, pure hydrogen, because it just leads to H2O. But pure hydrogen is very tough to utilize fully, as you know all. So we probably have to live with designer fuels with a bit more carbon in it. And our methanol is about here. The Fischer-Tropsch is an interesting next step, because then our trawlers and say boats and cars could use the same infrastructure, same engine, everything unchanged,
just a new type of fuel. So this is the sort of way to think about designer fuels. And in a country like my own, with no real hydrocarbons, we just make them. And of course, you may say, this is not totally renewable. And I say, yes, you're right. Until we can take the CO2 out of the atmosphere and finish the job. So it's a closed cycle. And I'm sure this time will come. The time will come that we'll be using CO2 and hydrogen together with some smart catalysis to make our own fuels. Next slide, please. This is the actual sort of nice molecule with methanol. We go through the power plant. We have a flue gas. We actually have to separate the gas a lot. We have a major reactor. We have a major electrolysis plant. I'm a bit unhappy that electrolysis in the world is governed by monopolistic companies. So electrolysis is very expensive. Maybe we could try to make electrolysis less expensive. Maybe with the methods we are developing in the project, you know. But anyway, what comes out of it is a methanol and, of course, water. Methanol has some problems with the environment. It has a relatively long lifetime in water, in the groundwater. So it's nothing comes without some sacrifices. But I think right now it's a very important step for us to create our own fuels, to reach the stage of a hydrogen economy where we are making our own fuels. Next step, please. I was very happy last year when we actually took a homemade methanol and we proved with a fuel cell. We lit up some lights, and we have two students. They were actually Polish graduate students coming to Iceland for a visit. This is in my institute, and the guys on the front line here are the directors of the Carbon Recycling International. But this is going to be a very exciting development for this company that is now, as we have proven, lighting the first electric light from green methanol from a borehole gas, you know. So a complicated story maybe, but a very elegant solution in the situation we are in. Okay, next one, please. Yeah, this is of course the great dream of a hydrogen economy. And we have there a battery hybrid. We're having some problems in Iceland with the pressure. Trying to keep hydrogen, but produce it, store it, deliver it 350 bars. That is a 700 bar possibility, which we're looking into, of course. But this is a battery hybrid, and we have done a calculation. May I see the next slide, please? We have this station. The station was opened in 2003. I was actually chairing this spin-off company then, and what we did, we got Shell with us, we got Daimler Chrysler and Norsk Hydro to help us with making a station for then running 3 buses, but today 25 cars. They can come whenever they like to the station. And my calculation or our calculation shows that if we have about 1,000 car fleet, a station like that now is profitable. So we're still working very hard towards this goal. May I say the problem is some reluctancy in the car business to play with us. They only make 1, 2, or 3 prototypes, very expensive. And until Toyota is telling me that they will start in 2014 with a full, very big fleet of hydrogen fuel cell cars. Maybe the Tomsk fuel cell work will make it possible to make an even faster development. Next one, please. Yeah, I've come to some of the sort of last much far-fetching possibilities we have in Iceland, because we of course realize that we cannot continue to harness the rivers for environmental reasons and other reasons, but Iceland is very well situated with the tidal forces of the ocean, of the Atlantic Ocean. Let us look at the next slide, which shows you a fjord. It's north of Reykjavik. Why can I not see this? It's probably not coming on, is it? No. Oh, coming on. There are very, very, very high currents there in this fjord of about 14 to 18 meters per second current somewhere. And if you think about the wind generator, you put a wind generator down in the ocean, you have the factor of 800 times density aspect of it. So there's an 800 times more energy in a flowing water of 18 meters an hour. And we're actually quite excited about the possibility of harnessing these currents in this fjord. But an easier first step, I'll show you in the next slide, where we take this same fjord, we take some parts here, we bridge it, make a bridge like this, similar to what actually the French have done at La Range in France, and we have just calculated the potential energy of these three fjords would give us about 200 megawatts of course, sinusoidal power. So the only problem is probably try to get rid of who can use sinusoidal power. Yes, a good network, a good net in a country like ours can always make use of it, we think. But of course it would be good also to be able to maybe produce, let's say, fertilizers from our electricity. Fertilizer plants can easily take periodic power. The good thing about this power is, though, that I could promise the buyer that 50 years from now, at a given time, day, hour, maximum or minimum, very, 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 very secure. The moon sees to that, right? What we will be doing is that we're actually working with the road authority in Iceland to work on the bridging of this fjord here. And I imagine that maybe 3 or 4 years until we can see this thing working. You may ask about the power of the station. It's going to be an average of about 60, 65 megawatts. Next slide, please. Because I come to the final part of my vision, and I'm looking even further afield, I'm looking 25 years into the future. And if you look at the map of my country from the energy point of view, we have been using a lot of the energy of the running waters, of the rivers. In some of the rivers, we still have one potential unharnessed. And this is the estuary. The estuary where the freshwater river comes to the sea and meets the saline water of the sea. There's an enormous difference in chemical energy between the freshwater and the saline water. Let's go a little further. Next slide, please. Ah, I should have placed this one differently. This is a Fourier analysis of the tides. Back with your mind a little bit. I just wanted to show you that the Fourier analysis is not very easy. It's not a monochromatic thing. It's like a combination of the main frequency, which we call the main tide, and a lot of other complicated frequencies because of anharmonics, reflections of skerries and islands and things. But let's go on, Tamara. So this is the idea of ocean salinity-based power plant. A membrane that passes water through itself into the seawater will create a lot of pressure, hydrostatic pressure, on the seaside, up to about 200 meters high, MGH, remember. And this pressure we will simply use to turn a generator, a turbine. And of course, the challenge is that for 1 square meter of the present technology of membranes for this, we can hope to see 2 electric watts. 2 electric watts per square meter. You put them all in a stack, like a fuel cell stack, and you hope to get a bit more. But our calculations and our calculations of our friends in Norway who are actually heading this research, Statkraft in Norway, shows that we need to reach about 5 watts per square meter to make this really an interesting choice. And the next slide, Amara, just shows you what we can do with this. If we reach the 5 watts per meter, we could reach some, if we just used about 20% of our river water, about 7 terawatt hours per year. Membrane efficiency is a bit of a problem today. I can see after the discussions here in Tomsk and in Novosibirsk, a lot of expertise in Russia. Can you imagine when you start harnessing the rivers north of Siberia, coming to the Arctic? Very exciting possibility, I think. I guess the Ob River, does anyone know how much the Ob River now produces of electric energy? I would guess a few gigawatts, I don't know. But anyway, you could add quite a lot to that energy if you could harness the saline, freshwater, chemical energy difference. Next slide. Last story to tell you. In the west of Iceland, this area here, close to Greenland, we have very fragile environment and very beautiful waterfalls. I would never turn this waterfall into a power plant, never. But with osmotic energy, we can just place a submarine power plant here, submarine or subterranean, and hope to get quite a lot of power out of this water without having to spoil the joy of this waterfall. We plan actually to build a small power plant near Mjölka. Mjölka is about here. And inaugurated on the June 17th this year. But it's going to be a very small one, a few hundreds of watts. But just to show how much this can mean and how important scientific research can be. Dear friends, this is about the story I wanted to tell you. Maybe one final picture of from my friends in Norway. These are the desalination columns. The concept is, again, an estuary. We are working quite hard with Statkraft in realizing this. But it is, as I tell you, sort of 25 years into the future. A lot of challenges, a lot of engineering challenges, chemistry, physics, all of it. And with those words, next slide, and I say, thank you for the reception here in Tomsk. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer questions. I have deliberately made this rather short so that you can ask questions. And maybe I will ask my friend Tamara to translate. Please.
Please select number 12.
Slide number 12, okay. Yes.
Could you tell me what is temperature in depth 2 kilometers?
Yes. Yeah, thank you for the question. It's a good question. The 2 kilometer depth is a very conventional drill hole. It will reach something like around 280, 290 centigrade.
Okay.
Okay. Right. At 5, we are approaching the supercritical temperatures. You know the phase diagram of water. Now let me add to this, because one of the challenges, for example, for engineering now, would be to bore down here and use a supercritical water temperature, and maybe put a reactor for taking sludge water, or a reactor to make the ingredients of designer fuels.
Thank you.
Okay.
I don't know
how I do this. Okay, they have a patent, but as physicists we know that you can just make an RCL circuit to filter out the high frequency and the low frequency. You just somehow actively try to filter out the 50 hertz component. You may have to have a very dynamical filter, and the most of these things are dynamical filters responding to very different conditions of the anharmonic, right? So basically it's a very, very advanced RCL filter. I cannot tell you much more about the detail, but there's a lot of little tricks, engineering tricks, that make this filter so broad. It can sort of address a lot of problems that come up. And most of all, the first...
I don't understand.
No, but let me tell you one thing. Okay. Oh, sorry, I would like you to understand one thing. Can I answer back? May I just say that if you can kill the high frequency distortions, they lead to eddy currents. Eddy currents in the engine room and all around this system. And eddy currents dissipate a lot of heat energy. And by filtering that out, you get rid of this dissipation. Sorry? No fuel cell. It's just an active electric engineering filter. I love this observation. Very good, I like that. Is it the metal electrode assembly? What do you call it? You have this. They are actually using quite sophisticated. I will probably discuss it with you afterwards.
Okay.
Is that okay? Yeah. Let's go to the picture of my petrol station. Can we go to the station?
Which one?
Where the car is outside the station. This one. Because what we did in Iceland was that, so we offered Iceland as a testing place for the new technology of fuel cells. We tested the infrastructure. We did a lot of work on people accepting. In many countries of Europe, people didn't want to accept it, and they were not allowed to build. So a lot of our work, and I like your question, has been about acceptance of hydrogen. We don't have
fantastic laboratories like here to create new concepts in fuel cells. I need to work with excellent people like yourself to do that, right? But we have a little society that is ready to be with you in developing the new ideas. So sorry if the fuel cell work in my country is not fantastic. Some of the other parts have been quite successful.
How do you see both hydrogen and energetic for Tomsk?
For Tomsk? Mm-hmm. Well, you need to make the hydrogen somehow. Mm-hmm. And
Which
way
hydrogen energy would be possible to be used in
terms? Yeah, let me first of all say that with fuel cells, you could be using combined heat and power of fuel cells to increase the efficiency of the use of your hydrocarbons. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first thing. Mm-hmm. Secondly, of course, I'm looking forward to the technology of nuclear engineering to involve a combination of nuclear and hydrogen production using heat and energy. There, of course,
I don't understand how nuclear engineering and hydrogen energy
So you're not aware of the plans of, for example, you're not aware of the plans of the French Atomic Commission to combine these two things? Then we have to discuss that afterwards.
I see. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for your very good questions. I hope others have some questions.
I have a question.
Thank you.
The question is not really belong to your presentation. So, okay. But you are also a philosopher.
Yes, yes.
Not only a scientist.
Oh, yeah, right. Don't forget that Newton was studied philosophy of science, philosophy, yeah. Natural philosopher.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's never forget that.
What's your opinion concerning the really effectiveness of CO2 emission on the climate on the Earth? Does it really do you really believe it, or just you follow the well? Propagated opinion that really we are affected by sun only, and this is just...
My feeling is that the effect is natural and anthropogenic. Then you ask me, what is the proportion? A little more natural, a little less anthropogenic, but it's there. No civilization on Earth has pumped out hydrocarbons in the way it has happened. So I definitely believe that this is a mixed effect. Natural effect is larger. But there's one anthropogenic effect not talked about, which is that clusters of ice, clusters of small particles of ice from our jets, they will have an effect like a climate gas on the reflection of the sun, of the heat energy. So there are many anthropogenic effects. Is not only greenhouse gases,
yeah, yeah.
Or I should say ice from airplanes is also greenhouse gas.
Yeah.
Is it enough to say one third anthropogenic, two thirds nature?
Thank you.
Okay. Right.
Okay, one moment.
Thank you.
Do you like to prepare some lecture for our students about to sail and so on, maybe another lecture next?
Yes, when I come next time, yeah. And I'm also, thank you for this question, because I've been talking to friends here about the possibility of offering one or two days of intensive renewable course with more engineering. This was more to give you the philosophical division. And maybe later this year we will have a such, and I would welcome all to participate in it. Thank you for the suggestion. We're already thinking in those terms.
Еще вопросы?
Нет вопросов. Well, respected Professor Sigmundsson, thank you very much for your lecture. Thank you again. Thank you. We hope that you will come to us many times and good successful study here and have a lot of new friends. Thank you.
Thank you all. Bye-bye. Thank you, Sabrina. Thank you.
May I have your presentation role just later? Well, to keep.
Yes.
Is it okay that we will keep the presentation for the students?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I hope people enjoy this.
Very nice.
Thank you. I want to put in one.
The only problem with the hydrogen has been to contain it, and the fuel cell is very efficient, so the only problem is storage. It's difficult to store hydrogen at these high pressures in a car, so it's all about storage. You understand me? It's not the, you have enormous energy, a kilo, but you need a lot of space to accommodate.